Welcome to this Julie's Bicycle podcast. For more information, visit our website, juliesbicycle.com.
I'll hand over now to the chair of this session, Alex McIntosh.
Thank you very much. I'm going to stay in my seat to set the tone for this session. I think we're going to try and be maybe relatively informal, but just give you a brief introduction as to why we're here. Thank you all for joining this session. It's great to have you here. We are here to talk about changing the narrative, or in fact creating new norms. So how can we make this agenda around climate change something that feels normal and part of our lives, something that we all take into account on a daily basis? I mean, in very simple terms, culture and creativity, and I'm reading now, they shape our material and conceptual worlds. The role of artists and creative businesses in provoking and mainstreaming new ideas and sustainable behaviors and reflecting on how we feel about the natural world are unsurpassed. So the question really is, how can and how should creatives leverage their influence to see the change that we need? I won't say too much about the panelists. I'll let them introduce themselves, but I will just say who each of them are. At the end of it here, we have Tim Lindsay, who is the CEO of DNAD. Next to him, we have Matt Black from Cold Cut and Ninja Tunes. Debbie Manis is the CEO of Keo Films. And then Rachel, who is a poet, needs no further introduction. I think that what I want to just say before that I hand over to each of them is that what we have here is a kind of, I think, a diverse range of people from different parts of the creative industries. I myself am Alex McIntosh. I am part of a research center at London College of Fashion called Center for Sustainable Fashion, so I guess the clue is in the name. The work we do, obviously, is looking at how fashion in all its various different forms can help to move us towards a better world and better lives for everybody involved in that industry. And on that note, I will hand over to Tim to tell us a little bit about his work.
Thank you for choosing me first. I'm Tim Lindsay. I'm CEO of DNAD. I spent my career in advertising and as such feel as if I've slightly come into the lion's den, but I've repented. And DNAD is a creative education charity. Our main sources of income are running a global advertising and design award show in the belief that the good stuff has better outcomes than the bad stuff. Commercially, certainly, socially, culturally, and even in terms of the environment. I'll explain what I mean by that in a second. Up until now, it was enough to encourage excellence in creativity in advertising and design, but the game's changed. It isn't enough for advertising in particular, and advertising is less thoughtful than the design industry about these things, to simply encourage people to buy stuff they don't need, often with money they don't have, to impress people that don't give a shit, which is one way of defining the advertising industry. So a couple of things have happened, and just let me mention them. Hopefully they're interesting. One is that big companies have begun to understand that doing the right thing is quite often the right thing to do commercially, led by companies like Unilever, who are serious about growth, admittedly, but sustainable growth. And the advertising industry has fallen behind in leading this discussion with its clients. It's failed, really, to develop the language, the strategy tools, the metrics, the understanding to lead clients, to help them understand how to put purpose, if not beyond profit, certainly alongside profit. There's nothing new in this. I mean, Lord Leverhulme believed that you could do well by doing good and built Port Sunlight back in the 19th century. But increasingly, this thinking is becoming mainstream in marketing and business terms. There's another factor as well, which is that there's a sort of talent brain drain, particularly amongst creative people, away from the advertising and design industries, because they're looked at slightly askance by millennials, if we're still allowed to call them that. And people emerging from arts universities, other places, look at the advertising business and go, I'm not sure I want to be part of that. It seems to lack a moral compass. So the people who we need to recruit in order to work in this business are looking elsewhere for their creative fulfillment, which is a bad thing. So DNAD, as I say, we run a big award show, started something called the White Pencil 4 years ago, and it is for creativity that seeks to do well by doing good. It's meant to be about demonstrating the power of commercial creativity to be a force for good in the world. And it's the most important thing we do, in my estimation, and we talk about it a lot. It's grown fantastically, which is encouraging when you think about it. And we've just broken it off, and we're going to give it its own time and place and name and run it in September in New York, still a global show. But the whole point of this is to encourage a point where the commercial agenda and the sustainability agenda intersect. Because once companies start doing the right thing by consumers and their suppliers and employees and so on, it kind of doesn't matter what the motivation is, we'll be beginning to move, in our humble opinion, in the right direction. So that's what I'm here to talk about.
Great, lovely. Matt.
Hi, I'm Matt Black. I'm part of a group called Cold Cut, and we started a label called Ninja Tune 25 years ago. And I guess from the beginning, I was interested in music having some content to it, music and art having some content and that meaning something. I listened to a lot of great black music when I was at college with my mates. That was a very formative time. People like Gil Scott-Heron, James Brown, and those messages did seep in and they became part of what I believe. I guess I felt that there was something there that was real and that spoke about the world, could look at the world and see there was a lot wrong with it, and this art and this music commentated on it, and it was powerful and inspiring, and I guess that is something which we want to carry on and keep doing. So our label is sort of proudly independent. I think we sort of took a slight anti-corporate independent stance from the beginning, looking at the way that corporations often act in a sort of clumsy and greedy way. We wanted to do something different from that. And we've attracted some artists to the label that share those ideas. And I think also want to have some messages and meaning in their music. Music can often just be, especially dance music, which is kind of where we come from, can just be about having, you know, funky noise and a heavy beat and people dancing. And whilst it's all very nice for us to get together, one nation under a groove, it doesn't necessarily make that much of a change. So artists like Kate Tempest, who we've signed a couple of years ago, who's a particular favorite of mine, also Young Fathers, who shot into the spotlight recently, they are people who believe in the power of music and the power of the individual to change things. And so I'm very happy to have artists like that on the label. Throwing Shade is another new signing that we've made who's also politically outspoken and articulate. So we're talking about how can and should creatives leverage their public influence. A couple of observations on that, perhaps. We've acknowledged that the power of the artist to reach an audience, and I thought the introductory talks here today were very inspiring and put that very well. One thing, though, is that does create a power imbalance because it's one way. It's a bit like a broadcast. So there is a responsibility for creatives to be thoughtful and to be genuine in the messages that we're putting out. Otherwise, and there's a question earlier about why perhaps ethnic communities are not perhaps touched by these messages sometimes, but maybe they can perceive that they haven't really been put in forms which are appropriate for them. Maybe they perceive that there sometimes can be a lack of integrity. I think people are very sensitive to when a person who benefits from publicity is putting out a message. Maybe there's a suspicion that the reason they're doing that is more to boost their own profile than in the message that they're putting out. And that does happen. And, you know, whilst, of course, it's very difficult for any of us to be completely sure about what our motivations are, what is the boundary between our beliefs and our ethics and our ego, we have to really look at that and make sure that what we're manifesting actually is straight up and has integrity. And we have to be thoughtful about the way that we do things. And I think actually that's the main point that I'd like to make today, is that we need to have a unified strategy amongst the community that we've got that share the interest and it realize and prioritize that the situation, that want to make a change with regard to climate, the environment, inequality, or whatever. We have to get the messages straight. We have to be coherent, and we have to design those messages properly. Now, the opposition, I don't always like to think in us and them terms, but you know, the oil industry is an opposition, and they put their messages very powerfully all the time, and they've been doing that for many years, and that's a large reason why it's been such a humongous task to shift people's opinions about it and make a change. We also have to be intelligent and creative and design our messages very carefully, and we also have to make sure that we've got a unified voice. I think sometimes there's been a problem with people in the community who do have platforms making quite out there, unsupported, exaggerated, or downright irrational statements with the best motivation in the world, but it can come out rather shrill and it can turn people off. I think we need to concentrate on having more unity and coherency in what creatives generate if we're really going to be effective. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Debbie.
I'm just going to show a clip first, if I can.
Can I just talk to you for a couple of minutes about your shopping? Yeah? Okay, so 16% of the food we take home, we throw away. Do you recognise yourself in that statistic? A little bit. Do you throw some of your food away?
Yeah.
Like when it goes past its sell-by date?
Yeah.
To save you the trouble of taking it home, I thought we could throw some of your food away right here.
Right.
So, for example, have you by any chance got any carrots here today?
Yes.
Yeah. So
yes.
A quarter of all the carrots we buy are thrown away at home. So can we start by binning one of your carrots?
Go on, why not?
Thank you very much.
One of my carrots.
2.5 kilos of potatoes, quarter of all of them. But you're going to throw them away anyway. That seems fair, doesn't it? One more for luck. But have you got a salad?
You can't open that.
I'm really sorry. Look, a third of all our boxed and bagged salads, a third of them get chucked away.
Why did you pick on me?
Terrific start. Yeah, we throw away a surprising...
So that's by way of an introduction to Keo, and also probably why we're here today. Keo is a television company, although we're called Keo Films, sometimes confusing. That makes all sorts of programmes, a wide variety of factual programmes, but it was started 20 years ago by Hugh Fernley Whittingstall, who you saw in the clip there, and a couple of other guys, a cameraman and an editor. And Hugh always had an interest in sustainability. As you probably know, the very first show that Keo was successful with was River Cottage. And they made River Cottage, which was Hugh essentially leaving London, moving into the country to see if he could live off the land. And it was an entertaining and very funny lifestyle show for Channel 4. And of course, typical creatives, after the first series was really successful, Channel 4 said, oh, can we have another series, please? And our creative director said, oh, no, we've done it all now. We've told the whole story. There's nothing more to show. And Channel 4 said, oh, just do the same thing again. It's fine, just do it again. 17 years later, we finally stopped making River Cottage, so doing kind of the same thing for 17 years. So I think that's why Keo has ended up doing a number of television programs that sort of sit in the environmental, sustainable, kind of ethical space. But we're a commercial TV company, and we're talking to an audience who need to be entertained. That's what we do. We make shows that the broadcasters can show and that bring a big audience. So the stories we tell have to be simple and they have to be entertaining. And I think that's very much where I'm coming from. I have to admit, I don't know a huge amount about climate change like most of the audience. but I want to make a difference. And I think the best way that we can make a difference is by putting entertaining television on the television channels and show people how they can make a difference. And that show Waste was on BBC One before Christmas. I don't know if any of you saw it, Hugh's War on Waste. And it follows a tradition we have of doing campaigning shows with Hugh. We made Fish Fight for Channel 4 as well. And, you know, what are lots of the things we do in that, stunts and all of that kind of thing, make it a very entertaining show and a very accessible show to the audience. And that show got peaked at 5 million on BBC One, and I think that's an amazing example of how you can get out what you're trying to say in a very simple and exciting and entertaining way. As it happens, Keogh's also done a number of other things sort of over the 20 years that kind of sit slightly alongside the television production, and have, in some ways, we've had to kind of section it off. We started a website called People Fund It that's now crowdfunder. You probably know that sort of specifically encourages people to crowdfund for ethical businesses. We also started something called, I'm now going to, for some reason my mind's gone completely blank. Oh, Landshare, that's right, which was a website for people to share land if they've got land they weren't using, for people who wanted to grow vegetables, et cetera, et cetera. But these things have proved to be things that are very difficult to make money out of, but we still think they're important, so we've kind of siphoned them off and put them into their own little kind of non-profit-making vehicle. So that's where I'm coming from, very lowbrow. But hopefully, I think, you know, we're in a position where we can really make a difference. And that's why I'm interested in being here today.
Very good. Thank you very much. Rachel.
Hello. So I am a poet, which usually means being in bed, kind of laptop on belly for the whole day, and writing. And I write a lot about my best friend Tiff, because she's fascinating. My mum and dad, because they're fascinating in their own ways. Their messed up relationship is, you know, just collections long. I facilitate as well when I actually do get up and out. I work a lot in schools across all ages, libraries, with community groups, so people with dementia, or women who have suffered domestic abuse or have had their children taken into care, and working a lot with young poets as well. And I set up a group for women of colour poets at the South Bank Centre back in September, because I felt that especially within poetry, there wasn't really a space where kind of what you wanted to write about, was always challenged or came up against a lot of opposition, sometimes in more formal institutional educational settings. So from where I did my MA, and if you take a kind of even a crude cross-section of who does literature MAs in the country, usually you are only the person of colour there, which is fine, but when you're writing about something that actually no one else in the room can maybe understand, and then beyond that are maybe a little bit hostile about it as well, not all the time, but sometimes. And so I knew a lot of brilliant young women of colour poets, and we'd had conversations and they'd said similar things as well. So I was like, okay, let's get a space and a room and we can sit and write and share and support each other. And also, I went to the South Bank Centre and they were stunning and they were like, yes, sure, this needs to happen. And it was only on the telephone to Alison when being invited to be on this panel that, and at first maybe a little bit like you, I was a bit like, oh, I don't know, because I don't know how much I know about climate change. But Alison said something that was really interesting. She said that how through the project that is Octavia, through setting up that workshop for women of colour at somewhere especially like the South Bank Centre as well, with its kind of literary prestige and how big it is as a centre for arts, how that is changing the climate, so to speak, the literature climate. Obviously, I was like, yes. Mm-hmm. thought about that the whole time. And when we're kind of left to our own devices and there's not like a guy's voice constantly just being like, well, I think this, or someone tells you a story about when they last went to Africa, even though half of us have not even been ourselves, we write beyond, you know, we don't just write about exotic fruits or spices or kind of mum's recipes and stuff like that. It's kind of a lot wider. It is about writing about your environment and the way, the unique way you see the world. And in those ways, I think there is a link between what I do when I get out of bed and being here and the things that we're here to do and want to do today. Also, just as I did say, I was going to be really quick, and now I've started like. Also, there's something as well in. Poetry, the kind of poetry that I like and the poets that I admire, don't try and kind of force something down your throat. You know, we're not preachers. We're not there to kind of, even though some people do, it's really bad. You have to sit through a lot of poetry nights where someone's trying, which I don't think in any setting that is effective, really. Or you are preaching to the converted sometimes. So I think the ways that we write about climate change and the ways that we write about our own environments, even if that is home, even if that's even a smaller macrocosm, even if that is writing about your mum and dad, how once you write that small, and I think that's what poetry is. Oh, sorry. What poetry is, you're kind of looking at something on a microscopic level, and how then it's left to your audience or to your reader to make it bigger, to let it kind of make its way into them and make up their own minds about what they want to do thereafter with what you have presented to them or made them look at in a slightly different way.
Thank you, Rachel. Fantastic. I think that I just had going around in my head, actually, when you were speaking then, something Deborah said right at the beginning about the power artists have to bypass your head and go straight to your heart, and that maybe that's the first question we should just talk about, is actually, are we reaching the heart of young creatives? Are we, you know, with this particular agenda or issue, is it kind of, how can we support the industries we're all part of to be talking about this, to be actually making it part of their dialogue? Anyone got any answers on that? Tim, maybe I'll start with you because you obviously
Thank you.
Do quite a lot of work supporting
so
young creatives.
Advertising is a funny thing because it's paid for by clients who spend money to grow their businesses, brands and businesses. But it has a lot of fantastically talented people in it, amongst them people who self-describe as creative people, you know, designers, technologists, writers, art directors. And they, I think, are increasingly beginning to feel, first, as I said, that they want some purpose in their professional lives. They just don't want to spend 100% of their time, more like 150 actually, selling stuff in a world, you know, where resources are limited and Earth Overshoot Day is on August the 10th or whenever it is this year. At the same time, you know, they have mortgages to pay and families to support. And so increasingly that's a drive for these things to be on the agenda, but it will only really be enacted by big corporations who, you know, are powerful, and when they see this, as I say, this convergence of the commercial and the sustainability agenda, and you know, I'm optimistic about it. We do see it happening. I mean, DNAD is a small organisation, but we've already had an impact, I think, in moving this whole conversation forward and the development of practical. As I said, practical tools that will help agencies make this happen with their clients. I haven't explained it very well, I feel, but if you and it's growing, you know. It is, in my humble opinion, it's not the only hope for the future. But if corporations don't do the right thing, then we're all in big trouble. And
So they have to be encouraged to do the right thing, and that has to become the right thing to do, and they have to be held to account and all that stuff that you know, has been discussed today.
You've talked about doing the right thing and the good thing. Do you, without wanting to put you on the spot, do you have any examples or think exemplars you feel really sort of...
I do, actually, and it's a Unilever example. It's a brand called Lifebuoy, which is a toilet soap sold in the developing world. And in to enact this sort of putting purpose alongside profit, they gave the brand the ambition of eradicating infant mortality in Indian villages. And they're serious about it. They spend proper money on it, and they support it with other programs. And the brand has grown by 15% odd year on year in the last... So it satisfies shareholders. I mean, these companies haven't become philanthropists overnight. They have boards and shareholders. But it is also, you know, successfully doing something that is about much more than profit. And there are lots of examples like that. Not enough, by the way. And what our white pencil attempts to do is gather those, encourage it, provide examples for companies to, you know, take it further.
Great. And one of the things I've noticed working with a lot of fashion businesses and running a fashion business myself is that many young people, and I don't count myself as one of those, but many people have an engagement with these things on a personal level, but when it comes to walking through the door at work, it just disappears, and it's just not there. And I kind of think, how can we get people to take those personal values and bring them into the workplace? And Debbie or Matt, do you have any thoughts on that in terms of...
I think people should get more angry, actually,
yeah, angry.
Especially the youth, because it's them that's having their future sold off, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of the old guard, probably including me, will have shuffled off by the time climate change were to really hit. So it's their future that's being sold off, and they should be really angry about that. And, you know, one's taught perhaps that anger is a very destructive and negative thing. Well, it is powerful stuff, but you have to be careful with it. But it also is an energy and a fuel. And I think that a lot of positive change that has happened in human history has, in fact, been fueled by anger against people speaking out and acting out against what is wrong. So, you know, the positive ways in which artists can contribute, you know, we're discussing those, and I think they're quite obvious, but I haven't heard it actually put that if I was a young creative, or even as a creative person, I don't want to put my creative powers at the service of businesses which are preying on the environment and on humanity. And people should realize that, you know, if you're doing that, you're getting paid to kind of, to fiddle while Rome burns, or worse, actually you're helping orchestrate that destruction. So yeah, I think people should get angry, and they should understand what their beliefs are and that they are powerful. And as you say, when they walk through that door into whatever job they've got, maybe they can apply that to what they do or the type of companies that they work.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Debbie, you're obviously really, your work is clearly very engaged with actually delivering quite a lot of factual information to people about, and how much have you seen, particularly, let's say, if we're talking about young people reacting to this kind of information being put out into the media space?
Really positively, actually. I was, and I think it's because you get, part of it is because, you know, we do it in an entertaining way, but part of it is also because you're giving people a real role and you're engaging them. So the things that, and that works both for people coming into the office as well as the people that we're engaging with in the general population. So Fish Fight and War on Waste are really good examples where we have a big digital campaign going alongside the television, and we ask people to sign up and we ask people to do something about it, and we try and get them to change the way they behave. In the office, it was really funny actually when we were doing War on Waste, because all of a sudden we thought, shit, what if the Daily Mail comes in and goes through our bins and we're making this show for BBC One? So, and you know, because when it is very easy in the office to be thinking all the time about cost and not, because unfortunately, of course, it's always more expensive to do the right thing. So anyway, we've now got a very good recycling system in our office, you'll be pleased to hear. But so actually, just in the work that we do, because we have to constantly be aware of what public image we've got as well as, you know, internal image, that's made us very, very careful. And we do, I mean, what you were saying about creatives, encouraging creatives to think about these things, I think my experience, people love the fact that we have this extra layer in our company of kind of ethical and issue-based kind of place. And as a result, we're a very, very popular production company. You know, everybody wants to work for us. So I think encouraging people isn't difficult to take up these things, as long as they, you know, they can really engage with it, I suppose. Mm.
Yeah, my experience is similar. People are always very, very interested. The problem is exactly what you just said, is the cost versus the kind of
ethics.
It's not
always, it's not always more expensive to do the right thing.
No, I know. It does feel like it.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you give us an example of when it hasn't been for you?
Well, I remember, you know, getting to know Julie's and I think Alison telling me that, you know, they'd gone to a bunch of festival companies and they'd pointed out that they were wasting a lot of electricity by having these rubbish old refrigerators, which were very inefficient. So they got in new fridges, which are a lot more efficient, and I think those, the festival companies, sort of got their money back in half a season on their investment in the new fridges by the amount of electricity they were saving. So there, they save money, they're going on saving money. The right thing was actually the profitable thing as well.
Yeah, great. And just going back to Matt's point about feeling angry. How do you feel about that, Rachel, in terms of young people and needing... You're definitely the youngest person on this panel. So how do you feel about the idea that we all need to be, maybe all of us, but certainly the younger generation, expressing more?
Yeah, I agree. Audre Lorde has got... very famous black American feminist. It's got a whole essay on anger and its uses. And I think we're always kind of shamed for being angry, feeling angry. There's always kind of a made to think that it's not pretty to be angry, and there are more effective ways of getting something across, which I think there are to a certain point. But then after that, and no one's still listening, it does become, I think, the most effective way, and maybe the only way that we will be listened to as people, young or old, or
totally.
Yeah, definitely. I'm angry. I encourage anger.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a difference with righteous anger as well, isn't there? So you're just not kicking off about something that doesn't really matter, or that you're selfish.
Do you think maybe we need to kind of that kind of righteous anger that maybe many people feel about their localized, you know, the things that surround them on a local level, we need to kind of try and engage on a kind of global community level, because this is obviously a shared issue that we are all going to be facing over the next however many years, or in fact the next 5 years, to get to what we were talking about earlier of halting emissions or stabilizing emissions by 2020. So how do we get people to transfer that maybe very personal kind of sense of into that maybe more collective? Yeah, go.
Well, John Lennon said that an artist doesn't make anything up, they just channel what a lot of people are thinking. Mm. And you could say that the sort of a prophet is the person in the audience who starts clapping at the right time, or the salt crystal that you drop into the salt solution, which makes it all crystallize out. So when there is feeling, there is widespread feeling in a lot of people, and yet it hasn't perhaps crystallized. Now we're in the moment of crystallization, and that is a moment when one feels in contact with all the other people that share this consciousness.
Yeah.
So that's a very good thing to encourage. And back to what I was saying about we need to link up all the people that share these ideas, find out, concentrate on what we have in common, actually, rather than you and I might disagree about whether, I don't know, whether flying is bad or not. Do you know what I mean? But we can agree on a lot of other important stuff. That's what we should concentrate on. Mm-hmm. We chart out what that territory of commonality is, and then, you know, more and more people will, I think, collect around that. And we should use that to then have a unified voice and message which is effective, more as a block, as a whole.
Couldn't agree more. Territory of commonality, we should take that and add that into the Climate Coalition idea. Okay, I'm gonna turn over to someone right at the back. Question there. I'm not gonna take it in threes, I'm gonna take it one at a time. Sorry, Renee, that you have to run with the mic.
Hi, my name's Sophie Thomas. I run a design studio called Thomas Matthews for the last 20 years. We do communication design and sustainability, but I've also been heading up Great Recovery Project at the RSA for the last 4 years looking at circular economy, which is I'm about to talk upstairs, so I'm going to be quick. It was really to Tim, because actually I have judged White Pencil a couple of years back, and it was an amazing experience. I mean, we, and Naresh is here as well, we had a very incredible couple of days. But I also had the most depressing time as well, because I also went into Black Pencil and helped. So if people that don't know, you, when you judge a White Pencil, it then goes into the pool, potentially, to get the ultimate prize for the pencil. So on one level, there was an amazing amount of understanding of the potential of sustainability in advertising in my industry and design. But on the other hand, it just hit this block of traditionalism and advertising. And I absolutely hear you that this particular industry, and I think it's quite common in a lot of creative industries, that we just don't have the language for sustainability, or we don't know how to talk about it to the others. Other sectors or other policymakers or, you know, the manufacturers, etc. So the question really is, you say you've been working with people like Unilever. Are you actually working with those that are writing the briefs in the first place? Because a lot of this is to do with the empowerment of designers and creatives, but also we are a service industry at some level, not like artists, but we have to deliver on a brief. So are you working with these guys to bring it into the brief?
I mean, it's a really good question. It's quite a sort of technical advertising and communications question, because the thinking has to start at the thinking stage as opposed to the execution stage. So the answer is yes, we have worked with strategists and a sort of coalition of the willing to, as I said, to invent the language and the thinking and the processes and the tools at the beginning. But I certainly don't want to come across as an apologist for advertising. What you experienced is the reality of the business. You know, it's beginning to change in some places, but most of it isn't. And we're much nearer the beginning of this journey than the end. I mean, what I would say, partly in reply to what Matt said, is that advertising, the whole communications industry, possesses enormously powerful weapons. And what they're good at, what we're good at, is getting people to change their minds and their behavior, which is kind of what's required here. Unfortunately, most of that power is being devoted to get people to buy brand B rather than brand A, but it is changing, and DNAD and many other bodies like the RSA are helping it to change, not fast enough, but beginning to happen. Does that sort of answer your question? Yeah. Yeah.
Anybody else? Yeah, just here in the right-hand block. Yeah.
Hi, my name's Ben Twist from Creative Carbon Scotland, which is a slightly similar organization to Julie's Bicycle, but in Scotland. And I think that last question is really pertinent, because what I often find myself thinking is that we don't know where we should be focusing our energies. And individuals often lack agency. There's not much that they can do to change things, although we need to change individuals' minds, and there's a whole series of behavior change questions around that. But the structures that you're talking about, I think, Tim, and that you were talking about at the back, are also really important. And I wonder whether we need to think more about where we focus that anger and who we're seeking to get to change. Because the people in with their hands on the levers of power, and we've seen this with Arts Council England and indeed Creative Scotland and some of the others who have spoken today, or we can think about, they have the power to shift things by putting those structures in place. And I wonder whether we need to focus more on where we direct our anger rather than just we've got to do lots.
Very fair point. Does anyone want to respond to that? Quite a tricky one. Just to clarify the question, are you actually asking us where we think the sort of anger, if that's what we're talking about, should be directed?
I think I'm saying that we ought to redirect it rather than asking, but if there's any comments, I'd be glad to hear it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think there's something in this idea of it, the institutions, which we'll probably come onto in the next panel, actually, what institutions can do both to facilitate but also to block the change that maybe needs to happen, and really is maybe back to the point about the white pencil, black pencil thing, is the will genuinely there to kind of create this change at the moment? Do you think that it is? Or is there actually quite a big school that is possibly standing in opposition to it?
I don't want to take up more than my share of our time. I believe changes are happening in the broader business community. Not fast enough, not, you know, in as many places as they should be, but I think, and to me, I'm sort of a practical person, getting those two things hooked together is not the, you know, not the only solution, but it's a big part of the overall solution. I don't think you can take, you know, the profit motive away and disallow it. I think you have to harness it and go with it. I think
so
that's
maybe conscious capitalism.
Sort of. Yes.
About.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Any other questions? Front row.
Hi, my name's Glenn. I'm from an art collective called Liberate Tate, and I just wanted to ask along the lines that we've sought to disrupt the mainstream by way of the different institutions getting BP out of Tate. And it's something that you haven't spoken to that much, but clearly there's a lot to be done in disrupting the advertising industry itself, the music industry, whether it be food waste or not. It's not necessarily taking ideas into the mainstream, but confronting the mainstream to be different. I mean, we wanted to turn BP's advertising into a massive amplifier for what was really happening with BP and climate change. And I just wondered if there's anything that you, the panel, could speak to about. I don't think we're short, as the other questioners said, of what needs to change. I think you speak to the environmental community, the scientists, and so on. We're absolutely not short of that. But what we are short of is channeling the energy into creative disruption. And I'd like to hear a little bit more about that. Thanks.
I'll say one thing just from our perspective. I mean, there are so many ways, you know, anger is one thing, then there are other kinds of ways of thinking about things, which is maybe just repositioning the way people experience a particular industry. So in fashion, we have one particular member of the center that I'm part of at London College of Fashion who's really trying to address the issue of fashion enjoyment coming from consumption as opposed to from use, which is effectively where we are. The main enjoyment comes from the process of transaction, not the actual enjoyment of the thing itself. And, you know, I think that's a kind of quiet and quite, it's not a kind of noisy thing, it's quite a quiet thing, but I think it's important that we maybe do think in lots of different ways about how we can be activists, not just holding up banners, not that I'm saying anyone is just holding up banners, but that maybe there are kind of things we can do that are stealthy, that get into those industries and do disrupt them without them maybe even knowing. I don't know about anyone else's thoughts on that.
There's something, talking about your own individual agency, so for the money in poetry is slim. So a lot of the ways that you make your money is through commissions. So being approached by certain companies who you perhaps don't share their views or politics, so using your own agency to say no, even when that will hurt, maybe like rent won't get paid, and how much of a sacrifice that is, but knowing that if you do that for the money, I won't sleep well. So in those ways, we can use our own individual agency, and also giving them the reason why in a very polite way, you know, never email me again. But this is why I cannot do this for you. So in those ways, we can.
Yep. Matt?
So Ninja Tune have employed an activist consultant called Richard Dent, a friend of mine, and he's working with us now because Ninja recognized that we wanted to be more politically and socially engaged. Everyone at Ninja works pretty flat out, so we needed to get someone who could actually devote some time to this and had some expertise. So I think that's an example of, as a company, we're actually prioritizing what we believe in, and we're making a space in our business for that, even though it's a cost and there's not necessarily a clear profit output from it, we think it's important enough to do. So, you know, Rich and I talked about ideas for this panel, and the message, I've got a message to deliver, and it is this, that we need to have a unified message, and we need to design those messages. So that needs to come from a focused expert effort to find the right message and the right way to put it across. So let's talk about some concrete things we should be doing. I think that's a concrete thing. Yeah. And I think that Julie's Bicycle are organizing an effort to do that, and that's going to be part of what we launch this evening. So we're really happy to support that. We need to hold the government to account on the COP21 agreement. Mm-hmm. You know, the governments do tend to try and slide out of things. We need something, a single campaign like the Big Ask or Make Poverty History. So that's something concrete that we should support as well. And you know, a mainstream policy lobbying campaign, that it could be that. The Guardian divestment campaign a while ago was pretty effective. Something like that that we can support as well. So again, I'd say let's decide what our message is, what our priorities are, get the message, detail it out using expert design and deliver it. Everything is advertising, actually. You know, we all advertise ourselves.
You use the word campaign a lot.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, actually, I go further. It's propaganda. Yeah. You know, advertising propaganda. They tend
or
to have negative.
Right? Mm-hmm. Or education.
Yeah.
If
but
you like.
You know, let's grasp the nettle and realise that actually we do want to change people's behaviour, our own behaviour, and other people, and that we're going to use all the tools that we can think of creatively to do that.
Perfect. Just, I know it says wrap. Really quick, we had Greenpeace to give a DNAD lecture a couple of months ago, and they very proudly said that a lot of the techniques they use in their campaigns are borrowed straight from, you know, commercial advertising and marketing. Thank God, you know, and how they're, you know, pretty effective. Sorry.
Okay, no, super. I think just to your point about propaganda, it springs to mind the quote from a 1930s, I think, philosopher called Martin Buber, who said, "The battle is not between East and West, it's between education and propaganda." Maybe that is something to think about. Okay, I think we need to wrap up now. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And I'm sorry if we didn't manage to answer everyone's questions, but hopefully there'll be more opportunities to ask in the following sessions. Okay, thank you very much, and thank you to the panelists.
Follow us on Twitter at Julie's Bicycle, and visit juliesbicycle.com for news and resources.